Yeah, 7 o'clock.
6 o'clock.
Like to get started so we can. It looks like a full agenda today, so we can take. Yes, we're still planning to take July off for good behavior and 4th of July and that, so we need to rock and roll. I guess I'm the man in charge tonight, which is scary because Don is out and about, probably exploring better parts of somewhere. I'd like to welcome everybody here. I see Don, and I see we've got our helpful staff behind us here. And off we go. Today's May 7th, and if we I'm reading May 7th. We'll call it June 4th, I'm sorry. And would somebody like to comment about the minutes of May 7th? Any additions, corrections? Found? I read through them. I couldn't find anything. Can I have a motion that they be approved? Okay. A second?
Second.
Okay. Been moved and seconded. Any discussion? If not, we'll declare the minutes approved and get on with our director, Don Benton. I'd like to give us a few words.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to the advisory committee. I just wanted to take a few minutes to kind of bring you up to speed. It's been a pretty darn busy year the last 12 months. We've just so busy, in fact, we're just now printing our annual report for 2014. Because there's so much good stuff, we had to pick and choose what to put in and what not to put in. So I wanted to give you guys just a few highlights. You probably know many of these things already, but from my point of view as the director of the department, I'd like to share with you some of the things that we've been doing to really turn the corner and do a better job of serving our customers. And one of the keys to that has been our new division manager, Pete Dubois. He took over after Anita left, stepped right up to the plate, got the job done, went through a very competitive process, and I can tell you I was not on the interviewing committee. I accepted the interviewing committee's notes from the candidates they interviewed, and it was a very tough group. I mean, it was highly competitive, very, very good candidates, and Pete came out on top in that process. And so he competed with the best and won, and we're very lucky to have him, as I'm sure you guys all know because you work with him regularly. But I couldn't be more pleased with the performance of the department and the job that we're getting done. In 2014, we tripled the amount of hazardous waste we took out of the waste stream with our household hazardous events over the previous year. And we did it with 6 or 7 fewer events than we had had the previous year. So we did fewer events, but we reached more people. Doubled the participation in terms of citizen count, but tripled the tonnage of hazardous waste that we took out. And we did that by spending significantly less money on advertising and marketing, because we quit using the 1950s technology, the newspaper, and we started advertising using a more modern technology called television, and boy, oh boy, were we able to reach more people. Wow, for a lot less money. So those events have been unbelievably successful, and we're gonna continue to do those. We're getting more and more support and buy-in from our city partners. Every week, I get a comment, and just got an email before I came over here from a battleground about how pleased they are with their relationship with us. So we have a very good relationship with the cities. They're very happy with what we're doing with these events, these community events. Of course, it's, you know, our regional obligation to try to do this, and I think we're very successful at it. This year will be the 10th year of the Recycled Arts Festival. Last year, we increased attendance and broke all records in terms of our attendance at RAF, again, using a more modern advertising, marketing, media approach, we were able to increase the attendance significantly. We had 90 hours, 90 volunteers that contributed over 360 hours of that event. It's pretty incredible when you think about it. We're moving forward very rapidly on our Leitner master plan. There are two members of the FARF, the city and the county, represented by myself and Brian Carlson. the FARF under the able direction of Mike Davis, our solid waste specialist in the department. We've been able to move the master plan forward. We secured a grant to help us with the master plan, and then we went back and got another grant for an adjoining property that we believe is contaminated. And we discovered that it was. We got the grant from DOE to determine how that would fit into the planning to integrate the entire site. Would have been rough for us to have this site with one little finger in it owned by someone else that's contaminated. So we're trying to figure out whether we can buy it, whether we can get the people to give it to us, whether we can get a grant to get it cleaned up. I mean, there's a lot of options there. We're not sure yet, but at least we know a lot more than we knew before, and that is it is contaminated. It does need to be cleaned up. And so we're looking at all the options on that. But the master plan for the actual Leitner campus has been completed. The directors of the departments have met, Public Works, myself, and others. We have selected the two priority alternatives that we think should move forward. We're in a position now, we're briefing the county manager, and we'll be bringing that forward to the Board of Commissioners for their decision, probably in the next month or two, I would think. We're not quite ready yet, but very close. And that's been a long, arduous process, but we've come a long way on that. Our green schools, I can't be more pleased. In 2014, we received an award for having more certified green schools in Clark County than in any other county in Washington State. And that makes us pretty darn proud, not only of our program, but very proud of our partners in the schools. We have worked very hard to develop a strong relationship with those partners. We have a strong relationship with those partners, as indicated by the fact that we have over 30 certified green schools now in Clark County. We are on a roll, and we're going to make darn sure that no other county ever touches us. Okay, we're going to stay number one in green schools in this state. It's working, and it's just a terrific program. Our sustainable forestry program, although not part of the solid waste program, part of our vegetation permitting and enhancement division, brought $750,000 in private payroll to Clark County. And so we're pretty excited about that. We're able to increase the growth rate from 1%. In other words, the forest was dying out at Camp Bonneville because it hasn't been managed in so many years. And on Green Mountain also was even in worse shape. I was up there a couple of weeks ago and they showed me off of one of the logs, one of the old-time foresters who knows this stuff. He says, you see this? He says, this is the growth of the first 10 years of the tree's life. I said, yeah, wow. He said, this is the growth the last 10 years. He said, this tree is dying, and in a couple of years it will be infested with beetles, and that will be the case with most of these trees. It's just overgrown and wasn't properly managed. So we've been thinning it according to sustainable forestry practices. We are certified by and belong to two sustainable forestry organizations. We don't do any clear cutting, we only do thinning. And we believe the growth of the forest will return. It takes about 5 years for it to really show, 3 to 5 years. But the canopy should be back growing at about 7 to 8% in 5 or 6 years, as opposed to dying. And so we've not only made the habitat better for the animals, we made the forest better, we've lowered the fire hazard. The number one hazard in urban forests is fire. And we're able to take the money that we've made from that thinning and put in infrastructure and roads that the fire department wants, especially up on Green Mountain because it's very close to residential neighborhoods. And we've been able to use the money for improvements out at Camp Bonneville. So all the money that we make off of that goes right back into improvements on the properties. So we're very pleased with the success of those programs. That's pretty much it. I mean, there's so much more to tell you. We've been doing so many great things with less people, less cost. We've reduced the cost of the overall department. The 2015-16 budget for the department is $8 million less than the 13-14 budget. The only county department to reduce costs, 15-16 over 13-14. Of any significant size, there were some smaller departments that may have reduced, but any department over $10 million in budget, we're the only one to reduce that expense to the taxpayers. And we've been able to do more. So it's not very often you get to say we spent less and did more, but that's what we've been able to do the last year and a half, 2 years with the Department of Environmental Services. And we're embarking upon new and exciting things all the time. You'll hear about the project tonight, and you'll get the update on... Hi, Councilman. You'll get the update on our paint reclamation program here tonight, and so you'll hear more about that. But we're very excited about that partnership with JL Industries. It holds a lot of promise, and we think it may hold promise in other areas too. So this might be just the first step towards a very vibrant JL Industries program that can enhance what we're doing. And also help the county offset costs at the jail. Our stormwater manual update is one of our biggest things this year, and that is we have to go for final approval now for the 13-18 permit. We've been in a year of revamping our codes. Towards the end of this year, the commissioners will adopt new codes to go along with the new NPDES permit. And we'll get that up and running in time to enjoy them for maybe 2 years of the five-year period. Then we'll have to do it all over again because we've got to do it every 5 years, unfortunately. So, but it's coming along very well. We have an incredible team in our clean water division who's really doing a great job on that. We had the first ever in 14 years EPA audit about 6 months after I got here. We knew they were coming. We got ready for them. And we found no negative audit findings. We're very proud of that. So we haven't had the official report yet, but on the exit interview, they indicated to us that the most serious thing they found was not that the work hadn't been done at one of the sites, it had been, but that somebody didn't document it in the little manual. And that was about as serious as our violations got. And so that's pretty darn good since it's the first audit we've ever had from the EPA. So we felt pretty good about that. I got the clean water rate up $11, less than a dollar a month. It was slated to go up over $100 when I was hired. We were able to complete the job with less than a dollar a month increase, and now we're fully compliant with all state and federal clean water laws without being under court order to do so for the first time in 5 years. So I would say we're making tremendous progress in the department in all of our divisions. Pretty excited about it. I was just out this afternoon at Heritage Farm. WSU Extension was a division of this department. We severed that relationship in terms of a division, and now our relationship is a vendor relationship with WSU. And we own the farm, of course, and they're housed there, and we do wonderful things with Master Gardeners and other programs there. Our Living on the Land program is run out of that facility. In fact, I ran into a farmer that was out there who was in there getting help, and we talked for quite a little while, and he is thrilled with the help that they get from that program. So we're getting pretty positive kudos from folks out in the community. But I want to come tonight just to give you an update on what we've been doing and all the positive things, because you'll never read about it in our local paper. So I wanted to tell you firsthand what we're up to and make myself available to answer any questions, anything that you've heard, anything that anybody said to you, any kind of rumor control, or anything you want to know more about, I'm here. And by the way, you can call me anytime. I'm available. All my employees know that nobody needs an appointment to see me. You can walk in anytime you need something. So we have truly an open-door policy, and it's utilized, okay, by the employees. So we're very happy about that. I tell the employees, this is my philosophy in management. I really only have two jobs. I have to make sure that you're happy at work, because if you're happy at work, you're going to perform well and do a good job. If you're not, you're not going to do a good job for the citizens. So I want to know if you're not happy, and I want to know why, because I want to try to fix that. And the other thing that I have to do is make sure that you have all the tools you need to do an efficient job at your job. And if you don't have those tools, let me know and we will get them for you. If I do those two things for every employee under my supervision, we will have a wildly successful department. And so that's my goal with every single employee, is to make sure they have all the tools they need, all the opportunity to get more training, et cetera, and to make sure that they're happy at work. If we do that, we're going to have stellar performance, which we have had over the last 2 years. I'm happy to report that I just received my 2014 evaluation from the county manager, and he evaluated me overall extraordinary for my performance in 2015. So I'm pretty pleased with that because it does reflect the successes that I've shared with you here today. So what other questions do you have for me or concerns? Yes, sir.
How did you reduce your budget so much?
Well, we were doing a lot of things we weren't required to do by law. And we shifted our focus to the things we're required to do by law. That's how you get in trouble and sued, when you use your money for things you're not required to do instead of for the things you're required to do. So we stopped doing some enhancements. We love to do them, but if you don't have money to do them, your first priority, obviously, is the requirements. Because then you get sued, then you have to surcharge your citizens to pay the lawsuit. And we don't want to have to do that. We settled a $40 million lawsuit for $3 million. So there'll be a surcharge on people's clean water fees for $5 a year for 5 years instead of $100 a year for 30 years. So we're pretty pleased with the outcome of that. We're going to make darn sure we don't get sued again. But yeah, we were doing a lot of things that we're not required to do. And we've shifted the focus to legal requirements.
Yeah, I mean, the forest, your exploration of the Bonneville Forest, I'm always interested in that.
Because sure.
As an Army reservist, I spent many nights out there.
I'll bet you
and
did.
The forestry practices, and I do agree that that forest was probably never abandoned by the Army for sure, unless we shot at it.
And there was a lot of that.
Yeah, there was a lot of that. Anyway, since we're on the Solid Waste Commission, what's your opinion of the cleanup that they do after the forestry? I hate those big piles of crap that pile up, and every time they do a logging operation, they make these teepee piles and leave them there for 10 years to rot. Is this being used as bio-waste, or?
Well, let me tell you what we do. Our philosophy in the department under my direction has been partnerships. The only way you can do more for less is by expanding and enhancing your partnerships with others. And so in reference to this, we have a tremendous partnership with fire stations and fire departments. And so last year, we took those slash piles and we burned them all in one day in conjunction with several different fire districts, and they use that as training for their hot shots. And of course, firemen have to be certified with a red card every year. And so all the firemen that were out there were able to get their red card certifications for that year. And it didn't cost us anything to manage that. And now in Green Mountain, what we're doing is, because it's very selective type of thinning, we are leaving a lot of the branching. We're not piling it up. We're leaving it spread on the floor. It will decompose and provide additional nutrients for the strong trees that have been left to grow. And so we're using a little different approach on Green Mountain.
I'm not worried about fire hazard from the waste?
No. They're just not that much of it, to be honest, because it's pretty selective thinning, really. There may be some slash piles, and if we end up with them, we won't leave them. We'll do the same thing. We'll have another partnership with the fire department, save them some money, save us some money, and do it, you know, in a well-managed fashion. So, but that's what we're doing with it. We have to be a little careful at Bonneville because there's still ordnance out there. That's it. A different operation where it's a very painstakingly slow process of cleaning up the ordinance, and it's going to take much longer than any of us ever thought it would, to be quite honest, because it's way worse than any of us thought it was.
Just like in Europe, you know, they found that great big bomb in Cologne the other day.
They find new ordinance out there nearly every week.
We used to find some funny things out there too. Any other questions for Don?
Well, when you say they find it, how are they finding it? Are they using metal detectors, or how are they doing it?
They use a combination of approaches. It's really dictated. We still have a strong partnership with the Department of the Army that dictates a lot of what we do out there. Public Works manages that piece of it. But now what we're doing is we found that the metal detector approach was not complete, frankly. It wasn't catching everything. We'd go back in behind the teams with our own metal detectors and find that they had missed a lot of stuff, especially on the valley floor. And so now they're actually going in and reclaiming 2.5 feet of the dirt grid by grid by grid. And that's very time-consuming and very costly, obviously.
Yeah, the handheld metal detector is going to go down a little bit anyway. So.
Yeah, I mean, we've got $3,500 metal detectors built. They're very expensive and they're very sophisticated, but even those aren't getting the job done. So they've gone to this much more expensive method. Because you just can't miss one. I mean, all it takes is one. You open it up for a park, and you have a kid that gets injured, and that's, so we just can't take that chance. We're going to spend the money and do it right.
So. You're doing it not to the whole valley, but just to the ranges where they were firing. Right?
Well, there's been some other areas. Prior to 1930, there was no record from the Army exactly where they were firing. So we found ordinances in places where it's not supposed to be, unfortunately. So that makes it more difficult, too. We know from 1935 on where they were aiming and where they were firing, so we've got a pretty good handle. And there's some of those areas that we will simply fence and will never be cleaned up because it's so bad. You just can't allow people in those areas, and we can't log in those areas either. It's just too dangerous for loggers.
If you do find an unexploded bomb, how are they disposed of?
They collect them, and we have an FBI range out there on Camp Bonneville, not far from where the FBI range is. We have Army ordnance technicians that explode the devices every Friday. They will explode any devices that they found. They'll set them off. That's how they do it. So, very interesting. Yes, sir.
I know that you were busy. You reported, and one of the things you talked about is the Leichner landfill master plan going forward. We just received this organic waste processing capacity study. I don't know if you've had an opportunity to review it.
No.
It contemplates a 20-year planning horizon for organics within the county, and one of its recommendations is to do as much close in as possible to reduce transportation costs of those materials. Mm-hmm. And one of the preferred recommended sites is that landfill. And I don't know what the master plan will govern with respect to using it for an organic processing facility, but I would advise you to consider that as a use for that site, as it's described in this report. So I take a chance to review this before you act.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no.
I wouldn't want to
absolutely
cut off our options.
Yes, we will. And our options aren't cut off anyway. There's a portion that will be industrial. We don't think we can ever site one of those as close to the residential area as that Leichner campus is.
We've got a variety of examples where that precisely has been done, close to residential areas.
Sure.
If they're properly enclosed and odor control is addressed. And the trade-off is cost savings for transportation costs.
Yeah, we went out and looked at a site that was quite a ways out as a potential site here not long ago. I went out with some folks from Waste Connections and others that we've been looking, trying to get this. We don't want to be reliant on the guys across the river. We want to do our own stuff. And that's created a problem for us, relying on them, frankly. And so we'd like to be independent. So we're desperately trying to, and that's why I'm glad the study finally finished, because now we want to take a look at some of those options and try to pursue those, because A, we think we can do a more reliable job for our citizens if we're doing it here on this side of the river, and B, we think it helps fulfill our obligation in the new chapter of the Solid Waste Management Plan in terms of economic development.
Yes.
So, I mean, those are two very good reasons to pursue it. And I'm sure the report will give us more than two reasons to pursue it.
It will.
Okay, good.
Yes.
But it's definitely a positive, something we want to do. There's no doubt about that. And so we're not going to rule out any option.
I'd have you read the report and become informed.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Are you talking to others about that master planning process as far as ideas or input from?
Oh, my goodness, yes. We've had
us.
The process has been arduous. We've had two or three open houses in the neighborhood out there. We've had several meetings wherein we have engaged not only the consultant, Small Foster, but they have engaged media outreach folks. They've engaged both residential and commercial real estate experts. And so the network has been pretty wide of the people that have been in the room looking at all the potential options. Of course, the landfill portion of stuff with a cap on it, we're very limited to what we can do on that piece of the property. Obviously, Department of Ecology is concerned about the cap and damage to the cap and whether or not we even get, whether they even release us to get out of the consent decree is still up in the air. But the property just south of that, formerly known as the Koski property, which you're now referring to as the Leitner campus area, where there is no cap and there never was contamination there. A slight bit of contamination in terms of a flume many years ago, that is gone now, that has been burned off, and so it's really not contaminated, and we are attempting to get the Department of Ecology to lift the consent decree on that portion of the property.
For light industrial?
Yes, and that is what's going forward. The plan for the rest of it isn't going to go forward until we can get Ecology to do something with the consent
decree. So I followed along with that, and I've been to the site and toured it, and I'm familiar with it. I just have an idea that I'd like to talk with someone about. Regarding that area, the light industrial area, that might be just something to consider, but I don't know at this point who in the planning process who that might be.
I think you should come and see me tomorrow.
Yes.
Okay. Because I've learned some things from, there's a manufacturing extension program that I'm familiar with, and they're doing some really neat things that you might want to hear about.
Great.
It's supporting manufacturing research and sort of integrating it, and there's a possibility here to combine that with maybe the universities, Clark College for the craftsmen, and you know, just building sort of a hub of research and make it, you know, how you have tourism for, we could have manufacturing tourism, have a big giant mecca of, and what it does is it brings an industry to the site, and it brings peace to the neighborhood, because there wouldn't be, you know, I think it would, it's just an idea I'd like to talk. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to get to it right here.
But the timing for this kind of thing is perfect, because we're in the middle of kind of shifting or refocusing, if you will, a little more economic development effort on our relationship with the WSU Extension.
Exactly.
And this sounds like it might be something. So the timing couldn't be better for this discussion. So please come see me.
I will.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Don. And I appreciate hearing from the leader of the force here.
And well, it's been really exciting. Don't get me wrong, it's been a challenge. Okay. But it's been exciting, and I like a challenge. I've had great people to work with. We have a terrific staff at the department. We could not have accomplished the things I've told you about today if it wasn't for the terrific team that surrounds me. And I really give them all the credit for it.
So. I have one comment to make here. I don't know if you talked about it, but Waste Management CEO made a statement that about recycling and how much it's costing. You haven't discussed that yet, have you, tonight?
No.
Okay, I just found the article, and I will get it distributed so everybody can take a look at it. He said because people just won't invest in it because, in fact, there's no money in it. And it is costing, I think we were saying that Waste Connections puts $100 to $200 million a year into recycling, and the rate of return is very, very poor, if at all. And so they're very concerned about recycling. It's the politically correct thing to do, but economically, it is not a driver. And so I think that discussion might be appropriate for this group to talk about, and for something for you to know, Mr. Director, also. So I will try to get that article out and dig it up and make sure that you get a copy of it.
That very issue, Councilman, has killed our block phone program.
Yes.
I mean, that very issue right there. The fact is that you can manufacture it from scratch, from petroleum products, cheaper than you can using the recycled material. So there's no incentive for anybody really to get into the recycling of the block foam. And, you know, people call us and they're angry, how come you're not taking block foam anymore? Because we don't have anywhere to take it, that's why. I mean, we can't. You know, what are we going to do with it? Pile it up out back, I guess, you know. But it's unfortunate, but that's the situation. And there's a little more money in the plastics, so we're able to still turn that. But not a lot. I mean, it's not a highly profitable business. So
weren't they compacting that and putting it in as blocks?
Oh, yeah,
into
melting it down and squeezing it into blocks.
And then you put those blocks in, for instance, on the fill on St. John's overpass. Mm-hmm. They were trying mm-hmm. that in there, et cetera, in that type of construction.
In fact, we used block foam for fill and glass for aggregate from you guys out at the 10th Avenue, that new interchange out Salmon Creek. So we use both. Yeah, block foam for filler. So maybe there's a new place for block foam, right? It maybe it's cheaper than dirt, so you fill up these empty voids with block foam instead of using dirt to do it.
Is there any way to go upstream and have, you know, the packaging in terms of
I think that's the way to go, to be honest with you. I think that's the way to go. I think that the legislature should put pressure on the manufacturers and get them to use something different or use something that's, you know, more biodegradable. The bottom line is it's not a health hazard. It takes up a lot of room in our landfills, okay? But if we have resources, we want to spend them on keeping paint out of the landfill, not keeping block foam out of the landfill. Because the paint will ruin the water supply, right?
Yeah.
The block foam won't. And so there are priorities in terms of what we want to recycle.
Sure.
And the paint, we think we can do it in a way that we can at least pay for the cost of recycling it, right? And so you'll hear more about that, I think, later tonight. So thank you.
Well, thank you. I think we need to go to our update, so we have to continue along.
We're going
to
let Don slide out.
Are you going to let me off the hook?
Yes.
All right.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
You
haven't
put in your 12 hours yet.
Let's see. No, only 11 today. Only 11 today. Although mine is usually the only car in the parking lot when I leave it. I can tell you that. See you guys.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks. And please, don't hesitate. Simone knows is going to come see me maybe tomorrow or the next day. Or any of you on any issue, whether it's directly related to SWAC or not, I welcome hearing from you. And if you think there's an issue or a problem or a concern, contact me. Pete knows I take citizens' concerns, especially those on my advisory boards, pretty seriously. So I'm just a phone call away. And so I welcome hearing from you on any issue. Thank you for your time tonight.
Thank you.
See you. Okay, on the agenda we have Clark County Health. Is that Melissa today?
We have Chuck.
Hi. I haven't met everyone. Chuck Hartman. I started with Clark County Public Health May 16th, so I'm getting ready to eclipse 3 months managing in the Environmental Public Health Group. And I am backfilling in for Gary, who's picked up, who I know a lot of you know, who's leaving at the end of this month. They wanted to overlap our time together. We're all going to miss Gary. They had a fantastic ceremony just there in the office. And I think a few people were able to make it on Monday. Very, very nice. So we're going to miss him. So a couple quick things. I don't think Melissa Sutton, who I know most of you know, is continuing to do her inspection work. What I've learned in my time so far, too, is that Melissa does a tremendous amount of work responding to complaints. I'm sure just like Environmental Services does, we get just tons of folks think to call public health when something comes up. One example is last Friday, she got a call about someone was piling up fish guts in their backyard out near Washougal. So Friday afternoon, she ran out there. As it turned out, somebody was smoking fish. There was no fish guts. But, you know, she had to go out and try to be responsive, and she wanted to do it before the weekend. So there's things like that, and then there's legitimate complaints, and if there's a code, WAC issue, then she'll follow up on it. But, so that's been interesting to learn about all the kinds of things that are coming our way and all the work that Melissa does. So just want to say that we've been monitoring, you know, the CPG, the Coordinated Prevention Grant budget issues. I know a lot of you are aware of that and have been monitoring it. And right now, I think it's just sort of wait and see when the budget's finalized. I know that, and I'm sure Pete knows about that, there's a work group that's forming. There's going to be a meeting next week, and we're going to be sort of plugged in on June 10th. It's a several different health directors and authorities who are just going to be talking about, and folks from ecology who are going to be talking about, okay, the 50% comes, what are the alternatives for how they allocate the budget that results from the legislature? And again, just looking at different, there's a whole list, and so that's on the 10th. And we'll be plugged into that and providing input on what we think are good approaches. And the only other things that I think are significant enough to talk to the group about, one is, again, we mentioned last week that, or last month, that Circle C Landfill, which has been closed for several years now, they've been requesting to terminate their post-closure permit. And so I've asked Melissa to work with Ecology. There actually isn't, like, real clear, as I understand it, law on what happens at, how do you close a post-closure permit? How do you terminate it? And so what I would like us to do is to work with Ecology on what are the criteria. And again, the real focus here is if we close that terminate that permit and they have no more requirements for monitoring of gas, water, wells, et cetera, we want to do it in a manner that there are no lingering issues that are public health or environmental issues, groundwater impacts, surface water impacts, potentially dangerous gas. So again, that, and I'm asking us to try to be a leader in that, and Melissa to sort of take the helm of that with working with Ecology. And I think the reason I mentioned that to you is that certainly once we're at a stage where we think, here's what we think is the right approach, we'll bring that to you to get your input, review and input. And then finally, at the last meeting, I know that it had been mentioned, we had provided the first quarter report that Melissa puts together under our grant, under the CPG grant, and it asked if there could be a monthly update with a lot of that information. And we talked about it back at Health, you know, what we thought made the most sense is that she's putting a lot of that information together quarterly because we have to for the grant, and that really made the most sense is to bring it to you guys quarterly and give you an update of all those details. I think all we'll say about that is I think that works with us. Let me know if you guys are thinking about it. I think we'd really like to know more monthly. The only thing I'll say is that I haven't had a chance to talk to Pete yet, but he and I have talked about us coming more to the meeting with some specific things that we're doing, specific examples of the work that mostly Melissa's doing, but also maybe some of the work we're doing in the site hazard assessment. So I'll work with Pete to bring more of those things to the group in future meetings.
I think it means more to us if we hear from you too about what's going on and who the boots on the ground are doing.
Yeah.
And then if we just get a piece of paper that has this. I know Melissa's reports are very detailed and I love her pictures, but you know, when you come, just feel free to share those things with us because, you know, we're auditorial, maybe at our age, we're auditorially fixed.
Alan, thanks. And again, I think that is worthwhile. We can talk about and show numbers, but yeah, Melissa comes back from many of her visits with very interesting photographs, and you can get a much better picture by seeing some of those things. So that's, yeah, thanks. We'll try to bring over that to the group.
Anything more for Chuck? Okay, City of Vancouver.
I'll stand that back here so y'all can hear me better. Our spring yard debris and tire coupon runs to the end of the month, April, early April through the end of June, so that's good for another month or so. Then I was going to talk just a little bit about the Washington State Recycling Association conference, which was in Spokane 2 weeks ago, 2.5 weeks ago. My key takeaways were on a few things. One was textiles. Textiles is another area where we could do more recycling of that material. San Francisco talked about the great job they're doing. And North Face has, like in their stores, depots, so it's like a return to retail program. And they've also got multifamily sites that have set up, again, San Francisco is fairly dense, but they've set up multifamily collection bins in multifamily homes also. And then several reuse options that were kind of pointed out. One was a mattress recycling and furniture bank in Tacoma that's being operated by a nonprofit, which has some pretty cool stuff. Lopez Island is also doing an interesting thing, which I think is unique to their disposal district. Because they're on an island, they're doing something called Take It or Leave It, TIOLE. Basically, you go to the transfer station, you leave something off, and somebody else comes and they can take it. But they've got really strict guidelines on what can be left. But since you're on an island and have to bring everything in, it kind of provides a really, really unique reuse opportunity kind of at the individual level. City of Bothell also got an award, as did these other that I'm mentioning, for their program called Buy Nothing Project. And the way that works is kind of like a social media sort of, I don't know if you're familiar with Nextdoor, Facebook, that kind of thing. So they have, I think it's a Facebook page. People that are members of that have something extra they've got in abundance, whatever it is, and they'll let people in their network know, and then they'll leave it in a bin on their porch, and somebody can kind of come by and say, hey, I need that, and they'll go and pick it up. And they said that when the Oso earthquake happened, almost a little more than a year ago now, they were actually some of the first responders to kind of bring in things like diapers that impacted residents needed, that kind of thing. Because they had this existing network and people that had stuff and said, oh, they need that. So they were actually there kind of on the same timeline as the Red Cross with kind of like tangible stuff that people could do. So that was an interesting piece. And then just another thing is an update. We had a good presentation from Washington Department of Ecology about the Washington State Solid Waste Plan, which is coming out, I think, in June sometime. I haven't seen the final version, but I think we've been following it a little bit. And so I think they can steal the thunder from the Washington Department of Ecology, that their plan should be coming out any day, so check the website for that.
Rich, just curious. We had the Too Good to Tell Us program. Do you know if that's still doing a lot, or is it kind of died?
Pete, I don't know if you're following it. I think they are still doing a little bit, but I might be old information.
It is still running, but it really never, because it was always competing with Craigslist, it just... Never had the viewer.
It never took off.
Never took off.
Okay. Yeah. Because I know it was kind of started, but then I hadn't heard anything for several years.
Yeah. What is that?
Too Good to Toss, where you could give away things over the by a computer. If you had something extra, you could either give it. I think there was up to $50 you could sell it for.
It
was just here in Clark County, so it was a.
I wonder if Columbia Sports, where you mentioned a couple of your vendors that make these products, also tip them back. You know, we have a big Columbia Sportswear operation in Portland. I wonder if they do anything about that. Also, there must be something going on because there's a fiber run for a charity. I know my granddaughter collected all my old rags and stuff by the pounds for some kind of charity that they're selling to someplace. And I suppose Goodwill has to get rid of their stuff too. So
it sounds like a lot of that, like reusable material, goes to gets exported.
Yeah.
And the one guy from USA Again did a presentation, talked about how they basically take and make a bale of used clothing, mm-hmm. and they ship it to Africa. And the folks there have to pay for it, so that's how they get this nonprofit gets some of their revenue. But then the people over there, it goes to, you know, say a household, and they have a whole business which is kind of like sorting out this clothing and giving it to folks. So you'll see stuff that, you know, we wore, folks in Africa are wearing, you know, because it's probably 90% still good. It's just out of style. So they're all wearing our old, I don't know, T-shirts that you got from whatever race it was.
Nike shirts.
And I'll do it.
Yes.
Okay.
The other way to get rid of things is take it down, set it on the curb, and say free, yes. And it's gone. I mean, I don't know where it disappears to.
Put a dollar price tag in it.
Goes faster. Okay. Thanks, Rich. Department of Ecology here.
No.
We know where his connections are.
Yeah, thanks. A couple things. Probably the biggest thing is, you know, we've talked about the slowdown of the ports all down the West Coast and how that affected the fiber markets. And, you know, at our peak, we were inventorying over 9,000 bales of fiber material. That's been reduced to around 5,000 bales, 4,000 bales, and we should have that cleaned up by the end of this month. So we're happy that things are somewhat back to normal.
What did you lose?
as far as the material itself, yeah. there was some that we couldn't save. You know, we had a team out there constantly tarping it, but you know, the moisture just gets into everything. I always tried to get our buyers to let them know that we were starting the pulping process a little quicker than our buy into that.
Where do you dispose of that, by the way, Scott?
Yeah. Pardon?
Where do you dispose of that?
If we can't sell it to any markets, then it goes to a landfill. There's no other option. I mean, if it's starting to mold and it's doing some...
I understand.
And we worked really closely with our partners, Clark County Health, City of Vancouver. They've been out, had numerous visits at our facilities, specifically West Van, and you know, we kept them abreast of what was going on and continue to do so. Recycle markets, you know, to Mr. Turley's point, and they, you know, I can't speak for Waste Management, but Waste Connections, I can tell you, I, you know, we're committed to what we do. You know, over 90% of our capital is in the recycling part of it. We just purchased and just actually was delivered. We have a new CNG truck brought into our fleet in addition to the ones we already have. That's going into our yard debris service. You know, but, you know, and sometimes it's not only market driven, but geographically where you're at. It can be a huge effect on where you're taking your recycling materials. Transportation costs are, I would say, a key component of that. And the tightening up of the quality of materials you have to send overseas has been a big part of that as well. Let's see. You know, the WSRA conference, if you ever have a chance to attend that, I'm past five-term president of that association, and I'm very proud of what we do. Our sessions are great, our speakers are great. I brought it to Vancouver 3 times, we'll be back to Vancouver in the next 3 or 4 years, and we just try to go travel all over the state. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Pete Mwaza, one of our newest board members, so it's great to have that Southwest Washington component to it, so appreciate that. Let's see, the our 2014 report is finished and complete, and I bring that up only to let you know that we, through our partners, the cities in Southwest Washington and the county, and also Clark County, and just give a presentation to them on that report, just kind of highlighting, not going page by page, but just highlighting some of the things we've done, number of calls that it could be safety, how many trucks, how many routes, how many calls we're answering daily, monthly, that type of stuff. And speaking of which, we do have a call service. It is here in Vancouver, staffed by real people in this community. We're very proud of that. And the calls in the queue can get staggering at times, but the average hold per call is less than a minute. So that's something we've really worked hard to get done and accomplish, and we're pretty proud of that. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to also thank you, and please take back to the people who care that you participated in a lot of things in the community, and I saw where your logo and everything came along with the Veterans Military Appreciation. So keep up fine work doing that kind of stuff.
Thank you.
And the call center, I'm an on-call person myself for my solid waste, and they do a good job.
Thank you.
And it works also on the okay, Pete, what you got?
Great, I'll be brief because I'll have a couple more opportunities to talk. But as Don mentioned, our division is doing a lot of work, and we always pass it down. Of course, we have incredible staff doing that work. We've had a couple of retirements. One was Jim Mansfield, who did a lot of hazardous waste work. We have another one, Leslie Johnson, coming up here July 5th. And one of our employees recently took another job, Karen Underhill, who is doing our Recycle Day events. So as of July, we'll be down to just 4 of our specialists, and we'll be looking at rehiring some of those folks. So we are looking to hire. And we do have a job right now on the streets for a communications marketing coordinator, and that's to help with some of our social marketing, some of our new outreach that we're hoping to do for the division and the department. So if you know of anyone, send to the county website. And RAP is coming up. It's our 10th annual, and it would be great if you guys could make a point to stop by. I didn't bring those postcards. That's something we might actually just want to mail out to SWAC. We've got some great postcards. Great. Certainly want to invite you there. It's a great event. Bands, over 150 vendors have shown up. We have to turn folks away. We take over the entire Esser Shore Park. And again, it's a great
when
Southwest.
Is it?
It's the June 27th, 28th. It's always the last full weekend in June.
Yeah, it's great.
And again, it's really, you know, it's made our mark too, and so it's a signature event that we do as a program and a regional partnership. We've got our clean cart study. We'll be probably bringing them to present to you in August. We went out and visited 14,000 carts. It took us 1 month to do that. We were very efficient. We have our sort. We did a pre-sort for those specific routes that those 14,000 carts represented to see what kind of contamination they were putting in the recycle bin. As Bill was mentioning, it's hard to collect and make recycling economical. It's even harder if people are putting garbage in their carts. We found about 20% of the carts did have some kind of garbage in it. So we go back on the 13th, and we're going to be resorting that sample to see how effective we were. But we got lots of great calls. I don't know if you want to share your call about, well, we won't steal the thunder, but there was...
Which call is that?
The clamshell?
Oh, call. The clamshell call. Apparently clamshell is not a term that most residents are familiar with. So we got a lot of calls from people insisting that they didn't eat seafood, so there's certainly clamshells in there.
We have tagged their bins with clamshell violation.
I got one at my house. It had styrofoam in it. It seems that my wife decided to throw a bunch in there, and so I didn't check it when I went down there that she had dumped that in there. So I had to give her a little lecture on that, which didn't go over very well with her.
For the most part, it was very positive. It was a good educational outreach. Yeah. It was our first effort, so we hope to do that again.
So 20% of those 14,000 carts were contaminated?
No, the actual of the tonnage that those carts represent,
okay,
20% is contamination. Now, we were very strict when we looked at those. You know, some of it could be frozen microwave boxes that have plastic, you know, but we wanted to get the baseline set.
Okay.
We'll never be able to educate down to zero.
Seattle, I have an article here that Seattle's fining people. They go through and they fine people $1 for each violation. And it says that they're trying to bring their goal up to recycling to 60% by this year, 2015. But
yeah, we won't be fined.
No.
We're educational. Thank you. And so I think with that, we'll wrap up that section.
Okay.
Thank you.
Waste to wealth, economic development.
Yes,
hero
so
for that.
We're going to invite up Chris Ripley is currently doing some temp work for the county. He has many, many years of experience in the paint industry. He's been working with us on trying to bring paint recycling to the county. And we've got a short presentation here. Thank you.
Hey everybody, my name is Chris Ripley. I've got a brief presentation for you. So I first started painting in 97 as a college pro painter. There's nothing pro about college pro painting. If you were thinking that that's who you're hiring, then yeah.
That's most con.
I got a really, really interesting opportunity to work with Sherwin-Williams on some of their paint development that year, which sparked my interest in paint manufacturing. Shortly after graduation, I had a good run at a .com in college, and I decided I wanted to take that money and get into paint manufacturing because it was sexy. So,
does that mean you go to college and you get paid for it and you paint?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Very much.
I
founded a number of different paint brands where I sold the largest residential painting company in New England, and we're arguably we're the largest residential painting company in America. That was a single operation. We've done about 14,000 jobs in about 8 years, just residential repaints. Been involved in some, bringing in some different, I've had a little bit of a background in chemistry, so we brought in some compounds that haven't been really widely used in the U.S., but are European and actually Japanese patents. We brought them in the U.S. And I'm a paint guy. I mean, it's what I'm interested in. And I've got two sides to me. One is paint, the other is technology. And what we're going to be doing here in Carr County is to merge both of them. One of my manufacturing businesses, Smarter Coating, started recycling paint very early on in my career, year two of manufacturing. Essentially, we were making a product that was so expensive that when somebody had a little bit left over, I mean, it was so expensive. I mean, $100 a gallon is what we were selling it for. And that was almost a decade ago. And people would say, well, you know, we ordered 10 gallons, we used 9. We've all been through it before. And so I had dealers around the country who would have these pallets of paint and say, you know, Pete, you know, this pallet is $22,000 or some number. And we would take that back and we would recycle it. And we never thought about it really as recycling. We knew what the value of the goods were in the can because we put them in there. We knew how to make it because we made it. And so we never thought of it as recycling. We just simply remanufactured it. And I didn't know at the time that would get me into another business. The key to remanufacturing is dispersion. So that thing in the top left is called a disperser. Imagine a huge KitchenAid mixer. It's about a 30-horsepower electric motor. 30-horsepower electric motor is like this big. And that blade looks just like a circular saw blade, and it spins at anywhere from 400 to 3,200 RPMs. And if any of you have a Vitamix at home and have left that on for a while, it turns whatever's in there into water. And so this is the innovation that isn't an innovation at all, because every paint manufacturer in the world uses this, but paint recycling wasn't. And so I ended up in Austin, Texas with one of my companies, and I was in the line at Walmart, and someone had this shirt that said, Austin Reblend Recycled Paint. And I, what's that? And I, this person turned around, and they were bubbly and excited and wanted me to know everything about it. So they took me by the arm. We went over to see it that day. And Austin, like many places, had been recycling or trying to find a way to not landfill or to transport all of this latex paint that they were collecting on HHW collection days. If some of you may or may not be aware, latex paint is not a hazardous waste, but it is really tough to deal with. You know, you take a quart of paint, chuck it in a swimming pool, and you can't see the bottom. The opacity is a big deal. And it also is very resource intensive. A gallon of exterior house paint now, manufacturing cost-wise, is about $8 of raw materials inside it, not counting the can. So it's by volume, I've gotten to work the last three neighborhood collection events to try to really understand our stream, is it's a huge component of what, by weight, it's over half of what we're collecting at these events. So Austin Reblend does about 30,000 gallons per year, staffed by full-time CIG employees, runs at a significant loss, and disposes much of the paint that it processes. Why am I talking about this? Because I don't want you guys to think that what we're going to do here is we're starting some sort of cute program where we're going to do something that looks kind of cool, and you know, at the end of it, we're going to have this big loss, and we're just going to end up burying all the paint that we recycle. That's not what we're going to do. I took a contract. The reason I came here to the Pacific Northwest is the Pacific Northwest is a geographic center of paint recycling. Metro Paint recycles more paint in what I would call recycling, which means that they take paint and they make it into paint, not the other companies that take paint and make them into colored wood chips. I don't consider that recycling, and then they landfill the wood chips. I don't think that's recycling. So Geographic Center of Paint Recycling is right here, and I got an early contract with Metro to help them do some process improvement. I was really impressed because they built that facility not understanding how to make paint, and it works, and the product's excellent. And for what it is extremely good. But they are missing key processes, and Metro is a gigantic organization. So we put some suggestions in with our contract, and you know, I don't know if they're going to be able to implement the suggestions.
Where's Metro Paint?
Oh, Metro Paint's on Swan Island, right here in Portland. So I was very frustrated. So I reached out to my network on LinkedIn, anyone that went to the same college that I went to in Massachusetts, and Pete Dubois' name came up, and I just started pestering him. I actually didn't know he worked for the county. He had something about recycling, and I was our technology is also about household hazardous waste, too, so that's the next thing that we're interested in. So I kept bugging him, and he finally asked me to come in and talk, and I said, this is what I want to do, and we moved pretty quickly on it. So we spent approximately $134,000 a year shipping our collected waste paint to Illinois. That's what we're doing right now. That's our modus operandi. And bigger picture, we have Stericycle is the housing Cowichan County's paint at Washougal, and also Idaho's paint in Washougal, and then taking paint from Idaho, taking it to Washougal, and then shipping it to Illinois. So paint is about half water, so shipping cans of half water to Illinois to then ship them to Africa, it's just a weird concept. I think we can probably figure out a better way to do it. We are not actually paying, we're paying this, Stericycle's handling it, but we have a direct relationship with Stericycle as a county. We also have a direct relationship with CRC, who handles it as well. And so we're going to figure out a better way forward. So we have a benefit, obviously. We're going to decrease waste, and we're going to utilize the jail work center. And
no pun intended.
They're spelling.
Oh yeah, the waste. We're going to decrease the waste. Well, first of all, I actually meant it because that's another goal of mine. This was from a different presentation that I reused. So we're going to be utilizing the jail work center, which was a really interesting experience because. Here I am pitching this program. I'm interested in getting it done, and it was, you know, this sort of this wow. How are you gonna handle this curveball that we're gonna have to use the jail work center? I'm psyched about it because honestly, that's the type of employee that Metro uses. Metro gets a lot of their sorting personnel from a reentry program. So I already know that. That seems to work. I've got a chance to spend some significant time at Jail Work Center with Joe Lofgren, who manages it, and watching them make a meal. I mean, it's a recipe. It's just like how you make paint. And honestly, they have to use more sophisticated tools to make a meal than they do to remanufacture paint. So I know we can use that group. And I'm actually excited because if we can make this work with that population, that population exists in other places. It's not just our deal. We're going to be providing a lot of high quality, low cost paint to the community, and we're going to lower the cost of disposal. So, for those of you who don't know what the Jail Work Center does and how it works, is so people that are incarcerated for less than a year are housed in this facility, and it's a low security. Deal. Actually, you can walk out. They've never had anybody walk out, which is a very interesting statistic, but you can walk out. Getting in is very difficult, but you can walk right out. We have 30 trustees currently, and I mess up the word inmate trustees, so if I mess it up this time, I apologize to whoever I messed it up to. Looking for a good time opportunity, and it's not the good time that you're thinking of. Essentially, for every day that they work, they reduce their sentence by 33%. So for 3 days, they reduce their sentence by a day. And the adherence is, I mean, it's pretty amazing right now, and it's a shame because it's a waste of a resource. But if you go into the laundry room, and let's just say the laundry room was this size, there'd be five or six people working, and they're six people standing against the wall, kind of at military at ease, waiting for their turn to go in and do something. And it's obviously not an efficient use of those six people's time, but there's a lot of other people that want to get involved. So we have a great opportunity, potentially, and this is something that we're looking into, to offer some HAZWOPER training. HAZWOPER is a great reentry opportunity. You know, I might not let someone who was convicted of something, you know, on my landscape crew, but we might let them sort garbage. And it's an in-demand position. I've spent a lot of time with Stericycle, and I've watched them have trouble getting guys that are HAZWOPER certified. For those of you who don't know what HAZWOPER is, it's an EPA certification that basically teaches you how to protect yourself against the hazards that that are present when you're sorting things like HHW. So it's a million pounds is about the number. I mean, it's a huge number. It's a million pounds. So we're going to take that million pounds. We're going to produce about 60,000 gallons of really high quality paint. And I'll tell you, as a guy that manufactures paint, and as a guy that manufactures ridiculously expensive paint, this is going to be good stuff. This is going to be in the. I believe it's going to be able to compete with the $30 a gallon price point at Sherwin-Williams, that quality level. Of course, we're not going to be able to sell it for that much because it's going to have the stigma of being recycled, but we will get something for it, and we're not going to be shipping it to Africa or making blue wood chips with it. And we're going to be Green Seal certified. Green Seal is just simply there's a number of different benchmarks that you want to get to in the paint industry, and Green Seal essentially says that it's a big long spec, and I could go through the whole thing if you like, but essentially it says that this is as good as this level of virgin paint. And it's been made with recycled components, mostly recycled components, and it doesn't have high bacterial loading, it's safe, here are the safety parameters, and that we've met that. And there's some inspections.
Who certifies that?
Green Seal is an organization.
It is an organization.
They work with the Master Painter Institute, which is an industry organization, and so they're the ones that bless that. I want to show you something because I just got this, and it's a cool toy. So everything that we do, I told you I like technology. We're going to render our whole paint processing line. So this is just something. So this is the JL Work Center, and those are going to be the sorting tables. And this is not complete. At all. You can see that there's some pallet racking with totes on it. We're missing about two or three implements, but this is how we're going to model this before we actually go and install it. So we will know exactly what we're doing before we break ground. We hope to break ground in about 6 to 8 weeks. It's depending on a blessing from the sheriff's office. They're going to take this into committee. We have had a number of meetings with them, and they are all ecstatic for a few reasons. One is this is a way to do what I think that they're careful not to say it's a mandate that they must provide these good time opportunities, but it is what their goal is to provide these opportunities for, and also for softer reentry. And it utilizes a resource that right now is just storing stuff. And by stuff, I mean you go in there and you're like, what is that? And you look and it's just kind of a big empty box. And you know, I mean, there's nothing else to do with that 2,500 square feet. So that's what we're gonna be doing with it. And with that, I'd love to field any and all of your questions.
Where are you getting your financing?
So there's a portion of the financing that's coming from the grant. And what that's going to do is we're going to buy about $75,000 of equipment. That $75,000 of equipment is going to be worth probably about $125,000 because that's why I've been buying equipment. So we get the benefit of having an asset that will have value. And a good amount of the financing comes from our folks at friends at Stericycle, because what they're doing is they're paying to ship that water to Illinois, and it costs money to do that. So what we've done is we've gone in and with our former colleague Jim Mansfield, who now is working with Stericycle, I've said, could you please stop sending this check over there and then just send this check over here? And it's a significant amount of money. It looks to be about $200,000 a year. And so, if you can imagine, Our total cost per man hour is about $1.75 at the jail work center. So you can imagine how far $200,000 a year is going to go. So it is our goal, and I think it's a completely reasonable goal, to make this a cost-neutral program this year and to make something back on it next year. And, you know, I'm the one that I want to be held to that.
What kind of entity are you?
I'm not an entity. I'm a temp. I'm working for Northwest Staffing. I work for Pete. But we will be, it'll be a county run facility, and there will be a marketing and retailing company similar to how Miller Paint markets and retails Metro Paint. We will have a competitive bid process where someone's going to come in and say, "It's my job to sell it."
So you're going to be a public employee? Is that it?
I'm not an employee. I'm just a temp right now, and I'm gonna. My goal is to make this happen, and if I can make this happen here, my value could be that I might win a bid to sell it if I'm so lucky. But if not, there's plenty of other places that would like to see this type of program be able to be instituted in the type of time frame. We're going to go from nothing on the floor to paint being produced in about 5 months, and that you know, in the government timeline, is pretty fast.
I look forward to seeing you on Shark Tank then.
Thank you, sir.
What he's referring to is that we should be able to produce about 50,000 gallons of recycled paint when we're up running full, and so the jail work center, through competitive county bid process, will ask for folks to come in and take that paint off our hands at a certain amount per gallon.
Is there a problem convincing the public that that's good paint?
There is. It's a huge problem. But in Austin, when I tried to do it, it became onerous. It was kind of ridiculous. Because here I'm testing this paint, and there's tests for it. And it's either good or bad. And I'm saying, this is better than all the stuff you're buying. And no, it's trash. Metro's done a lot of the legwork for us because they've been moving this stuff very, very successfully for the past 3 years. I mean, extremely successfully. And here's the real story. If you want to go paint your daughter's bedroom in the new color of the month this week, the least expensive gallon that you're going to buy to accomplish that task is going to be about $25. And you're probably going to, based on surveys, you're probably going to spend about $33. We're going to look, I'm sorry, Metro is selling this product at $11 a gallon. So at $11 a gallon, that price is so low that you get to capture a part of the market that just doesn't exist. And so that is enough reason for people to try to use it. And having used a lot of Metro Paint, I can tell you that it's worth $33 a gallon. So there is an incentive for the customer to try it.
Is it used for interior?
So we are going to start off making a blended product similar to Metro's, where they make a blanket statement about it being interior, exterior. We will shortly, after we get launched, start separating interior versus exterior. Because the exterior raw materials cost of a high quality paint might be $8. And the interior raw materials cost of a high quality paint might be $4. And this exterior product, when we sort it as exterior, we are going to be able to realize a premium. But more important than the premium is that we're going to have a group of people that now can say, I know what's in here and I know what it's good for. The problem, one of the stigmas of recycling paint, and I think it's a correct stigma, is I know this is paint, I know it's recycled, but what is it? Whereas our sorting process is going to say, this is what it is and this is what it's good for.
What kind of marketing expertise do you have with that?
So far, I've sold about $110 million in paint.
And that would be you?
Yeah, that's me.
And again, the marketing piece would be through the bid.
And it's going to be bid out. Someone's going to bid a number, and that number is going to be higher than the other guy, and off to the races.
You're going to buy your paint, and they'll distribute it.
They'll buy the paint from the jail work center.
That's correct. And they will distribute and sell it to the end user.
Yes.
So if I was an end user, where would I access this product?
Well, that'll be dependent on who buys it, because I'll give you an example. If Amazon Paint buys it, it's likely going to go to international markets. If Acrylitex buys it, these are both California firms that we'll send out bid opportunities to. If they buy it, they might put it in the Kelly Moore chain. If Miller buys it, Miller might put it in Miller. It will be interesting to see how the bid process works, but I think what's key to this, and Stericycle can't give us the paint or sell us the paint or, excuse me, pay us to take the paint until we have a demonstrated
end use.
Or else, you know, because many of the waste companies have gotten in trouble a long time ago for, you know, pouring stuff in the river. And so they're very highly regulated on having to manifest and say, this is where it's going.
Yeah.
And so that's going to be part of us being able to actually get the product coming in the door, is to be able to tell them this is where it's going out the door.
Could you spend a moment just talking about your process, about
Sure. What
your technology is and how you take somebody doesn't need anymore and turn it into this product?
So it's stupidly simple with a couple things that are complex. So the first thing is that most of the paint has already been sorted between latex and oil. So we are going to have a very small constituent of oil that just got missed by the first set of eyes. So we are going to have to make sure that we don't put oil into latex, because one gallon of oil, 100 gallons of latex, we're done. So that's there's a first sort of primary sort for, is this what we can even recycle? The second thing is reopening. And I'm juxtaposing the process where we're sorting it into interior and exterior by quality, and I'm starting off with our primary process that we'll be doing day one. We open it, we look inside, and what we're looking for is to make sure that it's actually paint. I'm not joking. In Austin, we have found pickles. We have found buckets of feces. We have found, literally, it was a bucket of pickles. I'm not joking. It was in a paint can. I swear it happened. Okay, it's paint. Now, my next question is now what color is it? And so those sorting tables are actually a lot like this layout here. So there's a pallet lifter at this end. It lifts up the pallet so that the worker doesn't have to stoop over. He grabs the product, and now he opens it. There's a tray here that he pushes it down, and in each, there's a hole or a sink with a grate over it. Underneath it's a 32-gallon Rubbermaid drum, a Rubbermaid trash can. You've seen them all. It's on a dolly. We go ahead and we fill that up. Now, unlike Metro, which looks at it and says it's either liquid or it's solid. If it's solid, we don't want it. And by solid, we don't mean rock hard. But if it's too lumpy, Metro throws it away. We love lumpy. We throw that bicolor into its appropriate 32-gallon can. Then we take that 32-gallon can and we throw it under high-speed dispersion. It wouldn't matter if there's a rock in it. That rock is going to be now a part of a pigment that's now part of the paint. And it's funny because actually originally, 30 years ago, and we have one of the coolest, if you ever want to do something going back into history, Imperial Paint has a factory that's circa 1940, still in use. So with ball mills and all kinds of stuff that no one in paint uses anymore. So that used to actually happen, where you'd have to grind things down that way. We're just using 1940s technology because it happens to still work. Now, once we put that under high-speed dispersion, we know what, we have a homogenized color, we know what the color is. We take a spectrophotometer, we measure what the actual color is, and we characterize it against a known white and a known black. Once we know exactly what the characterization and opacity of the color is, and we know what and we put that in a tote, and then the computer remembers this is what that color is. We have another tote, computer knows what that color is, and now the computer tells us what the constituent parts of each color is to meet our spec. Once we meet our spec, we package it, and we're done. Spectrophotometer is key.
Yeah,
Metro does it with syringes and toothpicks, and it's their bottleneck. And they're trying to buy a spectrophotometer It's just, it's a slowdown in their process. So we'll actually get that in front of them.
Ah, great.
That's great.
Great.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Thanks.
And if you want to slide up, feel free. We'll move on to the next.
Thanks, Chris. No problem.
You got your, you're going to want this, right?
Yeah, I'm going to
want that. I did have one question, though.
Oh, please.
Before you sit down.
Yes, ma'am.
Is there going to be any, I'm all for local sourcing and in terms of companies that are bidding, is there going to be preference? You mentioned Amazon, and I'm just thinking, you know, what are the opportunities for the small guys? You know, Bob's Paintland or somebody like that.
Well, I think that... this is an opinion now. I have no stake in, or there's no county part of this. I think it would be a mistake for anybody to bid on this and try to get it out of town. And I don't think anybody who will bid on it that wants to take it and send it to Africa will bid a price that would be the same as someone who is looking to locally retail it. The Amazon's operation, Acrylitex's operations, which I'm very familiar with, are based on massive quantities. They're a carting company, essentially. And what they're really interested in doing is taking massive quantities and dumping them off in massive ways. That is not a way ever to realize a maximum amount of return. So what I see happening is I see the winning bidder, because they can afford to bid more, is someone who's willing to put it at Bob's Paintland. Who, by the way, if any of you guys want to go and see an actual paint wizard, the guy who mixes paint there does it all by eye.
He's great.
And he's one of the only people left in the country that can do that. And it's it's an art that doesn't exist anymore, and he's better than the computer.
So there would be a distributor, and he would be able to purchase.
So the way I would see it is, and I hope this happens, and certainly if I were to bid on it and win, I would do this, is I would go to the Bob Paintlands, I would go to the Wilco's, I would go to all of the local establishments, and I would just source, because transportation, this stuff's heavy. Mm-hmm. 14 pounds a gallon. I know, I've been shipping it all over the freaking world. It's terrible at price. It's a terrible amount of money to pay to ship it. So I believe we can get rid of the vast majority of it right here. And I actually did show you guys, but I also have a technology to use the part of the paint that we can't recycle, because it's just, this is awful. We're not going to recycle it. So we have another, we have a way to get rid of that as well. So, and again, I hope to be back in front of you next year pitching you on our HHW plan, but that's neither here nor there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Melissa.
What's this? No, this is fine. I'll just stand here. Alright. Good evening, SWAC members and guests. Thank you for having me tonight. I invite you to think back to the last time, and this might be a little while for some of us, but the last time that you moved houses. And picture that house. And now picture there's probably a central location in your house where you started gathering your belongings and gathering boxes and packing the boxes, and this pile started to grow and grow and grow. And you probably asked yourself, how did I get all this stuff? Do I really need all of this stuff? And as this pile of boxes grew and grew, the number of days we had before the big move day were declining. And probably at the same time, our stress levels were growing. And for a lot of us, I know for myself personally in my life, this has led me to the transfer station, where very quickly I can get rid of a lot of materials, a wide variety of materials, all at one time. Just push it out the back of the car. Done. What's the next thing on my to-do list? And this leads to a lot of usable materials coming to the transfer station, things that are perfectly good, things that might be useful to families in need, things that might be useful for bargain hunters who just want to save some money, things that might be useful for people that are very environmentally minded and just want to consume less natural resources in the items that they purchase. And maybe for some people, our old stuff is just pretty cool. It's vintage. It's hip. So, many usable items come here. And we know the next process, generally what happens after this, is very quickly and efficiently handled. It's pushed onto a compacted 31 tons into one shipping crate, put onto a barge 3 times a week. We ship it 165 miles up to Finley Butte's landfill. But we do know that a lot of these items are useful. And as a waste reduction specialist for Waste Connections, I work on the education team there. And our team, what we do, we talk to people not only about recycling practices, but also about reducing their consumption and reusing items as much as possible. We do that through presentations, we do that through publications. One of the places we've been doing that is at the Recycled Arts Festival, where we run an exhibit called The Tossed and Found. So for many years, maybe since, do you recall when The Tossed and Found began? 2008 maybe, or before?
That sounds about right.
It's before I was working at Waste Connections that this was a tradition, running The Tossed and Found. At this, we would gather items for a little while from the transfer station and then showcase them at the Recycled Arts Festival. And this was this year we had a 30 by 40 tent filled with items that were perfectly usable. The biggest wow items we could think of to display where people would say, I can't believe someone threw that away. Look at this canoe. I can't believe somebody threw that away. It sold for several hundred dollars at the retail thrift store after this event. Here are some other year's items that we showcased. When people come to this exhibit, we talk to them about other options. Too Good to Toss has been an option that we've talked about, Craigslist. You can give items to many thrift stores in the area. Donation boxes are all around our community. Give to a friend, hand-me-downs, put it on the curb with a free sign, put it on the curb with a $20 sign. However you want to get rid of the items, they're perfectly good items. This last year, we saved items for the Habitat for Humanity Restore as well. We had one dumpster filled showcasing construction and demolition materials. No matter how much education we do, people will still come to transfer stations just to get rid of usable items quickly and efficiently. There are transfer stations around that have programs for that. Metro South has one where they have a thrift store employed there who gathers items from the customers that come in that they can resell at their thrift store. And Rich mentioned Lopez Island, where they have a take-it-or-leave-it program. People leave items there, and other people can just take it if they like it. We tested out a usable materials program. It's a pilot program, and it started in September. It will end on June 30th, a temporary program just to test out what would it be like if we collected items at the transfer station and donated them to a thrift store, just like we do for the Tossed and Found, but year-round. And this is what our program looked like. So I'll walk you through what it would look like if you were to participate in this program coming to the transfer station. First, the customer would come to the scale house, and the scale house attendant would ask every customer that had a load of garbage, do you have anything that's still usable, or do you have anything that you could donate to a thrift store? If they say yes, this person would radio to the tip floor, and there was an attendant there in a certain colored helmet, and they'd say, okay, so you can look for the person in the pink helmet. That's what the lady chose that worked there. And she started a trend, and all the ladies in my office had to get pink helmets. So she had a pink helmet on. And then she would radio also a description of the car over, and so they could connect on the garbage tip floor, and that would be one last chance to get the usable items off to the thrift store. We discovered that in this conversation, almost everybody said, no, I don't have anything useful. I don't have anything worth donating. That's why they're bringing it, right? They think it's junk. So here, and maybe it sounds like an extra step still has to take place to get rid of this item. So most people said no here. We just continued asking at the scale house after a month or two. But we still asked everybody on the tip floor. And this was our first employee in the position, Haley, as the usable materials attendant on the tip floor. And she would go to each car and ask if they had something to donate. A lot of people then said yes, because she's showing up with a friendly face, a cart. This is very easy. All you have to do is put your item into the cart, and I'll take it away and donate it. And she would even give them a donation receipt. And they would get then a flyer that would direct them to come to that thrift store or another thrift store, inviting them to donate directly to a thrift store in the future. On the side of the tip floor, you can see that there is storage containers. And we used these to store the items in that would be donated to the thrift store. The packing materials that you see, this is the flyer that she would give them. And inside one of these containers, she just went on over to the recycling tip floor and grabbed some cardboard boxes. We get a lot of bubble wrap over there, plastic bags, anything like that, and brought it over. That's what we could wrap breakable items in. These were all lidded. It's a very dusty, grimy environment if you've ever been to our tip floors. This is keeping the items a little bit cleaner. Some items stored to the side of the tip floor. Now, once it was full on the tip floor, she would ask a forklift driver to come and pick up those crates, and we could just carry the crates or any of the bulky items down to a job shack that we put onto the site for this specific purpose. So it was a watertight area, and we could hold the items there for about a week. And we had the thrift store come. Friday mornings usually was the best time. We had the most forklift labor available then, and then we could clear out the job shack for the weekend. And these are some items that we saw in there. Foosball table. And when the retails driver came, he could talk to our usable materials attendant and they could have an exchange, a conversation about the items. And if there was anything that seemed like the thrift store wouldn't want, it was very easy just to leave it behind. That couch, for example, they decided was too soiled, so that was left behind. Transfer station staff would help load the thrift store truck. Here are some pictures of things that we've found. Lots of furniture come in, really unique looking furniture. Some furniture comes through, it's in the middle of a reupholstery project or something like that. Maybe somebody's given up on it. But quite a few very good furniture items come through that the store has been really pleased with.
How did you determine what thrift store got to?
We chose.
You said you brought something to Habitat for Humanity and in your load, but that's not the one we saw in the computer.
No, that's right. One year at the Tostin Found, when we collected construction and demolition, they were the obvious choice to have that for Humanity Restore. They were also at the Recycled Arts Festival, so they just drove their truck down and we loaded right up all those materials. We have worked many years with the retail's Habitat for Humanity thrift store at the Tostin Found, where we gave most of the household items. And we already had a really good working relationship with them. So for this pilot project, we chose to continue working with them.
And that's the Humane Society?
Yes, the Southwest Humane Society thrift store. A lot of decor and home knickknacks come in. This was a really large wall hanging, and it had four matching pictures that went with it.
I have a question.
Yes.
So, did you find out any reasoning why folks are not choosing to donate these ahead of time before they get to the landfill, or was there any?
Yeah, we had some conversations. A lot were people in a hurry.
Yeah.
A lot said that they were cleaning out a home for somebody that had passed away, and they were very quickly getting rid of the items.
Sure.
Another person said that she specifically did not like the Goodwill and specifically did not like Salvation Army and was choosing to throw them away. And our staff person had a conversation with her and she decided she would be okay with sending it to the retail thrift store, the Southwest Humane Society. The issues were from a customer that was delivering items from a deceased person. These are brand new shoes that they never wore and they're brand name Roma's dress shoes. Yes.
Are those still around?
They are, yes.
They are retail.
You'll see them at the Recycled Arts Festival. I saved these to showcase,
yeah, right.
And you can go buy them from retail.
Is that a size 12 by any chance?
If I zoom in, maybe I can find out. And these are children's toys and gear that have just been outgrown. They were still perfectly good, and that was from the woman that said she didn't like Goodwill or Salvation Army. Bicycles come in a lot, and we'll donate those currently to retails. Some of them, if they don't sell or aren't in usable condition, they can then get money for the metal. It's kind of some joke items, but the office plants come in, so many office plants, and the retails driver started joking with Christina, who was collecting. He'd drive up and he'd say, "So how many house plants do you have for me today?" So lots of those, and then a lot of unopened bottles of wine. We're not really sure why those are coming through, and we don't save those or donate them.
You don't save them, where do they go?
They go to Findlay Buttes. So here's just to numbers to reflect where we are in the pilot project so far. There's 2 months, 1 month left, and this reflects through the last report, which went through April 30. So at the end of April, we had diverted 16,144 pounds, and that worked out to be about 8 tons, or about 2 tons per month diverted of usable materials. That accounted for 1,122 items, and that's counting sets of items as one item. So if a set of silverware came through, we didn't count every fork. It was one for the set of silverware. Retails price the items just like they would price any kind of merchandise coming to their floor. They priced everything at $7,246.09 altogether. Of that, $3,791.46 has sold so far. Not everything is sold. It's still on the sales floor waiting for somebody to come purchase it. That is where we are with the project right now. We'll have to decide what happens after June 30. And so we are going through these numbers right now and discussing future options. And with your input, we'll find out what the next steps for this program is. Any questions about the project so far?
Keep doing it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful.
So, well, that's a good lead in. For one, Melissa's done a great job.
Don't forget garage sales in your discussion.
Oh, yes, we do encourage garage sales. Interestingly, after the garage sale, a lot of times people will pack up all those items and they're coming straight to the transfer station, which is why our usable materials person switched her schedule to include Mondays. That's a pretty hot day for getting these items.
It is. Melissa's done an incredible job tracking all this stuff, and then the sort floor attendant is remarkable because it is very difficult working conditions there, and a lot of turnover with these folks that flag the people in. And one of the pieces that has helped this program is they've been able to use our grant dollars to give her a marginal increase on her salary, which is basically up for minimum wage. So most of them are making minimum wage. I think she was making $4 or $5 over that, like $16 an hour. And what we were hoping to do, we were hoping to get a SWAC recommendation if appropriate. Our grant runs out, but we want to keep the program going. And it currently is costing, with grant dollars, about $3,000 a month to run the program. We can't have retails, again, those are for 4 months, so they're bringing in about 1,000 a month. But again, that's to cover, they have to drive out there, they've got to sort it, they've got to do all their costs. So we can't really hit them up for money, and that wasn't the intent. One thing we can do, and this actually was Derek, who's the regional manager's suggestion, is the current flagger, because she's also doing a lot of flagging work, but we were able to use grant dollars to pay her as though she were focused on this project. If we can cover her marginal cost moving forward with our program dollars, and then possibly bring, there's about 5 other flaggers on location, maybe choose 1 or 2 of those flaggers, give them an intermediate pay bump, so maybe give them $3 raise to focus on reuse and to be more customer service oriented, then we could run the program at about $1,000 a month and to continue that for 6 months. So it would be a $6,000 commitment recommendation, which is, I think, valuable to see if we can continue to somehow make this flagger type process. And then there's avoided cost for each of those 8 tons, again, which doesn't add up to a whole lot of money, but that's money that doesn't have to be spent shipping that material up river to the landfill. So in a long, convoluted way, if we wanted to make a motion either this month or in future months to continue this program, I think it would be appropriate for SWAC.
Where does the money come from?
It would come from our solid waste program budget, which we have available. Yes.
I'd like to see it go with Melissa being here and being worthwhile. Sure, gets a lot of stuff out of the stream, and I'd like to make a motion if I can, as the leader, to do that. Second. In favor?
Aye.
Let's do it.
All right. right, thank you. Hats off.
Thank you.
Good job.
Cynthia, was there some reason we didn't get copies of the stuff this time? I went through and read everything on the computer, but I didn't see that we didn't get hard copies.
There's hard copies in your folder.
Of the organic?
That was 55 pages. That's the only reason I didn't print the organic one.
And I didn't see anything in there about the solid waste that I read about either.
I printed it out.
Oh,
you? I print it, I read it, and bring it to the meeting.
And then are you referring to the spreadsheet there?
Say again?
Alan, is that what you're referring to, the spreadsheet?
No, I was wondering why he had one and I didn't. I print on me.
Oh, he printed his
own. Takes a lot of paper.
I read it, but I had to remember a lot, and that's hard to do.
Yeah.
Okay. March of Unintentional, that was really good. We did the foam.
I think we've covered foam. We certainly can answer some questions.
Yeah.
And let me pass this around to folks as well, just since you're referring to that. Take one and pass it along.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We can throw a couple of. What's that?
Big.
I know, with color ink on it.
And half the tree.
Yeah.
Half the tree.
I know.
That's
right.
Not an agenda item, is it?
No, but he's going to refer.
Okay.
So, actually, so my question is, if they've stopped collecting foam because they don't have a disposal avenue for it, it's not economically viable, I assume those are kind of the underlying rationale?
Well, the discussion here that we wanted to just bring your attention very quickly. And Rich had an opportunity, he mentioned it, that Washington State Recycling Association conference he was at, to speak with a manufacturer of a densifier that can actually take a 53-foot tractor trailer load of block foam and compress it into ingots, and that those ingots are marketable, but there's a cost to invest to get that machinery.
We saw a similar operation with coffee cups. They took the foam coffee cups and collected them all from like Boeing, and then they could put them down into a quart-sized jar. You know, we're talking a room full. Yeah. And where would that be based? Like at?
Well, we were thinking again. This is, we wanted to keep it in the grant.
That's where my question is going.
Yeah. So the reason to keep it in the grant is. The grant, they look at the bottom line dollar, but you can't spend anything that's not in the grant. You don't have to spend what is in the grant because you can shift the money around if you overexpend in other areas. So the idea here was to keep it on the table in case
there's an opportunity.
We clearly have the need.
Yes.
And we would probably need to find either a private enterprise, and there is one in the Kent area that possibly would want to come here. Could use a jet work center. I mean, there are options, but they are unknown at this time. We haven't spent a whole lot of market research to go down that road.
Okay. That answers my question.
So that's it about block foam.
So Portland will not be recycling either if they use that same.
Correct.
Because they've been told.
Now, that they want to bring it back online, so again.
They got the same issue we do.
Yeah. Oh, but, you know, again, putting all your eggs in one basket, it can get shut off. It's on again, off again, and it's really not a, you know, you have someone drive all the way across town to drop the stuff off, well, you just wasted more resources than you saved.
Okay. Would there be any other people, places interested in utilizing this service to help us, you know, make it cheaper?
Again, those are possibilities.
What's Portland doing with their trucking enough to?
It's probably going to landfill.
Yeah, they're stuck.
Well, the whole thing about block foam is just the cost of transport.
Yeah.
I mean, 53. I mean, you know, you could take a 100-foot truck, and it's not going to weigh anything. Yeah. And you can't make much out of it because it's all air.
I know. Yeah. And we fill one of the 53-foot tractor trailer every 3 weeks, which is from this community, and that's without a whole lot of marketing.
Do they pull that from the construction material, too?
No.
The block?
No.
felt no economic incentive.
Maybe I'll mention the one item. So there is a company up in Renton called Styro Recycle, and they are kind of across the street from the big IKEA warehouse up there. Everybody's been to there, which is just like a huge facility. And the woman that runs it actually started at IKEA and said, "We've got so much stuff here, we're having to pay the landfill. Let me look into recycling." So this was, I think, 6 or 7 years ago she started. So now she's an independent business with 12 employees. They recycle foam from all over Clinton County, bring it to this facility and densify it. And you've got to densify, then there's a really good market, whether domestic or export. So that would be kind of the opportunity that might be here. So it's part of the waste to wealth idea. If we could get somebody doing here, and maybe they're associated with a business or a few businesses that are generating that as part of their business. Taking material from the public could be a small part of that piece, but it would really have to have a business case, a business plan would have to be done that says, yeah, this is densifying as a project that will work for us because we've got the material.
Just a suggestion. We've got IKEA Cross River in Portland. Why don't you call them up and say, what are you doing with your styrofoam? Maybe there's a pathway.
Yeah.
Wait, is that different than the warehouse?
I'm meeting with Jim Quinn on Monday.
Well, IKEA.
But Jim, don't worry, he was saying also that Portland has
a distribution.
I don't think it's a retail outlet that's doing it. It's where everything comes in and gross quantities of styrofoam. Where the idea here is that they don't get that much styrofoam to make it worthwhile.
Maybe, yeah. Well, maybe it's the end user because you open the box and it's got styrofoam in it as part of the
They send it, yeah, to you, but I mean, it isn't. It isn't a distribution center.
Right, yeah. That makes sense. You're just selling you a cardboard box full of stuff.
Yeah, full of styrofoam.
Okay, Pete, better go with organics.
Yes, we'll keep moving right along. Thank you for your stamina and your commitment. Local organics processing, this is a draft. It's an early draft. I just had an opportunity to read it in full detail as well. We have an issue. We've got a growing population in this region. You know, the report mentions we're going from 440,000 to 680. With that, it's going to come more organic material, and we have fewer and fewer places to process that. So we obviously knew that clearly going into this. The intent of this report was to get a clear roadmap on how we can move forward as a community to make sure that that's properly managed. There are some details that have been left out, in my opinion, that we need to work with on the next draft. And specifically, we know that West Van, which really was only permitted for 20,000 tons, was underwater in 1989, I believe, with the Great Flood. So not a great opportunity there. Plus, we have a commissioner or council member very adamantly opposed to having any kind of odor potential in that area. I don't know if that's safe to say, Rich. I think Jeannie's made that pretty clear. So I think that was communicated back that that's probably not an option. And then the Leichner, and I need to reread that section, but to me it sounded like they wanted to do it on the capped area and that there had been precedent set to do it on a closed landfill.
I read this a couple of days ago, and my memory is not as great as it was, but that's the general impression I got.
That was my impression.
Certainly that site.
And so I think we would want to, because they're certainly moving down that light industrial as a way to spin that off, sell it, have it repurposed. Right. But clearly the 70-plus remaining acres are open.
Yeah.
And they're in the middle of that area, and if it could be done, to me, that seems...
Do you have any sense, and I'd have to read it again, but what I didn't have is a sense of the footprint that would be necessary for a facility to handle the volume that they're forecasting.
And that, to me, is what's missing, and I think we need to get that into this next draft.
Well, they showed some of the sites.
But, I don't think they talked about acreage specifically.
No, but they haven't built it. You know,
they did.
They didn't have it spread out like everybody did. I think about it.
They did.
It's interesting stuff.
And that's how you
would... Another thing that bothers me about it is Melissa and I went to see Dirt Hugger.
Yes.
And that's where it's currently being taken up there by Waste Connections. One truck a week is all that goes up there.
It's because that's permitted for the food.
Right.
And so the rest of ours are going to Scappoose, which is a beaver bark, I believe it is. So the yard only material goes one place, and then the food waste is what's going to Dirt Huggers, which again is a 100...
No, it's 90 miles.
90 miles.
90 miles.
One way, 180.
Yeah, but it's only one truck a week.
True.
And, we went through the old facility, and I asked them specifically when we were there, they said, bring it on. We can take it all. And they moved east so that they're on the other side of town in the flow, smell, and everything, which there was none.
Sure.
I couldn't believe it. Sure. They have a really good operation. You know, I know it's 90 miles, but, it's only one truck a week.
True, but we have competing interests as well. We've got all the metro region that needs to move their stuff as well. So this is, again, we'll bring this back when we're a little more fleshed out. I just wanted to make sure you had the latest draft we're working with, have a little preliminary discussion. Clearly, we want to have a roadmap that we feel comfortable moving down. And we'll need to get by off many,
when you do
many,
it again,
steps.
Please print us a copy. That's not fun reading the CRT for 52 pages of it.
That's why I printed.
You know.
Double-sided.
I'll have Cynthia reach out, figure out who needs what the best way. And thank you for pulling together those CDs that went in the packets. And Cynthia's been a huge asset in getting all of these materials prepped, also all of our grant materials, FTP, so we don't have to send mountains of paper to ecology. So we appreciate that.
Did that plan get adopted then in number 5?
Yeah, so our plan, and if anyone is excited to come to a council meeting, because they are exciting, it is scheduled for June 9th. They will be adopting the solid waste management plan, which really this commission has ownership of being behind. So Dick's been through many...
Is that a morning one?
Many iterations. That is a morning one, yes. 10 a.m. And where we are, we are close to the finish line. We have all the interlocal agreements signed from all the cities. We're still working, with the exception of Vancouver, we're working with them. Their interlocal doesn't expire till the end of 2016. We've got resolutions in the works for all the other jurisdictions to adopt, and then we'll package that up, send it to ecology, and they have 45 days to just say it's official. So we are months away.
Do you have any feelings of any problems at the commission?
No, this is on consent. They might pull us to talk about the good things we're doing. But thank you all, because it's a big achievement, and we're getting close.
Okay, as our time is flying, Pete, you said something, you need our recommendation on funding.
I do, and I didn't need to print out this huge piece of paper, so my apologies, but if you look on this column that adds up to $1.8 million, that is what we proposed our two-year grant to be. Brandon can probably speak more about this, but and Don left. But for many reasons, and most importantly because of the decline in the price of petroleum, which predominantly funds this, the legislature budget, both in the House and the Senate, have discussed about that coming in at 50% what they initially thought. And so this, give or take $900,000 is how we would like to move forward, because the grant officer needs to know if we only got half the money how we'd spend it, so we can start preparing our grant, because they need the document, and that goes into effect July 1st. So what I am hoping for, and if we run out of time or if we need more presentation on this, Rich and I went through this, so we've got the city buy-in. Our hope was have SWAC make a recommendation, that we're okay to proceed with the 50% funding plan, and then we would ship that to our regional partners, which are generally the public works directors from all the cities, probably tomorrow, and say, are you okay with this approach if we come in at 50%? And then I'd ship that to the grant officer and say, here's our plan.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but your general strategy, as I look down the notes section, is you absorb a lot of costs on your side, on your funding.
Staff funds, yes, because we would build a grant for our staff time.
Yeah.
Correct. So we don't need to lose... We wouldn't need to lose, really, in the programmatic area, anything significant. We need to cut back in some areas. And as I did mention, with this grant, with the exception of a couple tasks falling off in number four, we still have the ability to shift dollars if the need arises.
Why do you still have block foam on there?
Again, that was to keep that as an opportunity in case we wanted to move forward with an economic development opportunity. But we aren't going to be spending any money on that unless that moves forward, and that would only move forward with this recommending commission.
The only thing I see, everything's doubled from one year to the next except for the latex paint. What is the difference on the latex paint?
The difference with the latex paint is we are only funding the startup costs, and then after the grant two-year cycle, the jail work center would fully assume any cost and any revenue.
So we'd only spend $50,000 the next
year? Correct, because the big for year one is we bring in the $75,000 worth of equipment. Okay. Year two, we just help with marketing and some training.
Okay, do I hear a motion?
So moved.
A second?
I second it.
Okay. He needs a recommendation. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion passed.
Thank you.
Cool. You don't have to. You can now. You can do recycling and reusing, and don't have to do budgeting. Yeah. Any other business brought to be brought out? Again, we saw article in the Columbian, which we don't always believe anyway. It says, I'm watching them throw apples out in the middle of the cornfield and plowing them up, you know, as waste. That roughly a third of the food produced worldwide never gets eaten. And that's a... Not in my house.
Especially when the port shut down.
Okay, any other good business? People with us. If not, let's call the meeting adjourned, and it's 2 minutes. So,
what do I say?
We're not in a meeting next month.